Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. The Cursed Car. My family has had a bout of bad luck that revolved around the Y-56 Ford Thunderbird, or, as it has come to be known in our family, the suicide car. It all began back in 71 when my Uncle John came back from Vietnam. About a week after being home, he had bought the Thunderbird off of a young woman who practically gave it to him. My dad had asked why the woman was so eager to get rid of the vehicle, but John would just say, "It has some bad history." According to my dad, my uncle and the car were inseparable. My dad even said he had joked that John would end up being buried in that car. As irony would have it, in 75, my dad found the car parked down by the river. My uncle was slumped over in the passenger seat, a self-inflicted gunshot to his head. The car sat in my grandfather's barn after that. In 79, my dad's cousin Tom had purchased it from my grandfather. Similar to John, Tom's life revolved around the vehicle. He spent practically every penny he made restoring it. In 82, Tom was showing off the vehicle at local car shows. In 83, Tom overdosed with prescription medication and alcohol in the passenger seat. At this point, my dad's family considered the car cursed. My grandfather, a superstitious man, ended up locking the car up in his barn, not wanting to sell it, as he didn't want to strike another family with the supposed curse. My grandfather passed away in 97. All of his belongings were divvied up, including the car. My aunt, not the superstitious type, took it and ended up giving it to my cousin Robert. I feel like most of you already know that things didn't end up well for Robert. Robert was extremely popular. He was the homecoming king, varsity quarterback, and student council president. So it came as a real shock when in 01, Robert was found dead in the passenger seat of the car in the garage with the car running. The car is now in a storage garage up north. Last I heard, no one has laid eyes on it since 01. As far as I'm aware, there is only one picture of the car. The picture my uncle took the day he brought it home. Working the night shift. My name tag reads, "Hi, I'm Jimmy. How can I help you?" I work at a gas station in a forgettable little town in Illinois, about 6 hours south of Chicago. When I was a kid, I never thought I'd end up working the graveyard shift 5 nights a week, 100 feet from the off-ramp. I always dreamed of being a firefighter or a teacher, maybe even playing guitar in a rock band. But by your late 30s, you start to realize the difference between dreams and reality. I don't know whether it was my own bad luck or my inability to stick with college, but I was stuck working from 9 at night to 5 in the morning for my paycheck. Que sera, sera. You meet a lot of interesting people in my line of work. Maybe interesting isn't the best word. I'll just say there's a lot of characters roaming around at 2 in the morning. To tell the truth, I like the night shift. It's slower, and I get paid an extra 75 cents an hour. Though, I haven't been robbed yet, and I'm sure looking down the barrel of a gun would change my tune. I have my regulars, and I've come to enjoy their company, mostly. Some I could do without. They're Scratchy. I don't know his real name. But he comes in around 11 nearly every night to buy $10 worth of instant lottery tickets. There's Mrs. Fletcher. She lives down the block and rolls up on one of those mobility scooters every week to get milk and cat food. Nice old lady. Made me a plate of cookies last Christmas. One of my favorites was Steve, and not because he was a great conversationalist. He wasn't, as far as I knew. I only know him from his name tag on his McDonald's uniform. He sometimes rolled in around 3:30 in the morning to get gas before his 4 a.m. shift. Whenever I saw good old Steve, I knew it wasn't long before I got to go home. Those are some of the nicer ones I get to interact with. Now let me tell you about one of the nasty ones. It was a Wednesday morning in early spring, I think. I was reading a horror anthology. King, Bradbury Block, the usual suspects. An oldie but a goodie turned off Main Road and rolled up to the entrance. That's what I call classic cars. I always liked older cars, and since I started working here, I would often glance through the many hot rod magazines we sold. I recognized it immediately. A 1978 Diamond Jubilee Edition Thunderbird, all black with tinted windows. A tall man with pale, drooping features stepped out. If I had to guess his profession from how he was dressed, I would say something like funeral director. A black suit jacket hung from his rigid frame. I noticed mud on his shoes and the hem of his slacks. I nodded and mumbled, "Hello." He walked to the aisles, ignoring my greeting as if I didn't exist. He brought a box of garbage rolls, a roll of duct tape, our biggest sized bottle of Clorox bleach, and a hacksaw to the counter. And yes, we sell hacksaws. You'll find them between the ratchet sets and the shot glasses. I make it a rule not to think too hard about what people buy. It's none of my business unless it's an underage kid trying to buy booze or wannabe meth maker trying to buy up all our cold medicine or nail polish remover. The old guy's selection was suspicious, but suspicion and guilt are two different things. It wasn't until I rung him up that I got that uneasy feeling that comes so easily to someone who works alone late into the night. He pulled a small red purse from under his jacket and rifled through it. A long, uncomfortable moment later, he pulled out two $20 bills to pay for the stuff. I glanced at the purse in his hand and noticed a woman's driver's license amongst a jumble of items within. That wasn't really strange. Married couples often co-op each other's wallets, checkbooks, debit cards, and various other devices used for payment. It all went towards the family's needs anyway. But his two perceptive eyes caught mine looking. I counted his change and handed it to him. He smiled, but it seemed more like he was baring his teeth. For whatever reason, he reminded me of a predatory animal gloating over wounded prey. "Your name is Jimmy?" he asked. The accent was something I had never heard in real life, only in movies or television. It was something Eastern European, very thick, too. "Yes," I replied. "Let me bag this up." I bagged it, then pushed it across the counter. "You work alone at night, do you?" I panicked, said nothing. He smiled again. "See you around, Jimmy." I was glad he was gone. I hope I would never see him again. Some people just make your skin crawl, and I'll be damned if I could really tell you why. It wasn't his transaction, but his presence. Does that make sense? I'll admit it doesn't. Maybe I shouldn't read horror stories when I get bored at work. As my manager likes to say, if you got time for leaning, you got time for cleaning. 2 nights later, I found myself grabbing the local paper. I saw a woman's face. The story was brief. She had left the bar 2 towns down the highway a couple nights earlier. She never got home. I didn't know this woman, but my mind insisted I'd seen her face before. But the mind plays tricks. I see a lot of faces. Who am I to make a fuss without something better than a fleeting look at a woman's face and a driver's license? Spring turned to summer, and sometime in late June, I had another visit from the man in the black Thunderbird. This time I knew I had seen something I shouldn't have. He walked inside stoically and made his way to the bathroom in the back. I noticed his hands were coated in something red. I wanted to tell myself it was ketchup or maybe paint, but I knew it was blood. Tiny scarlet drops fell to the floor, creating an intermittent trail leading to the back of the gas station. I considered running to my forest green Cavalier, accentuated with Bondo and rust, but I choked down the rising terror, telling myself no one could be so audacious as to partake in a foul deed, then walk in public with blood-soaked hands. I reasoned that he must have injured himself, right? What murderer in his right mind would walk around with bloody hands for the world to witness? But murderers aren't in the right frame of mind. And is a gas station at 3 a.m. really that public? No one had been in for nearly 2 hours. I heard the bathroom door open and my whole body tensed. I stared, paralyzed by the man's approach. Now his hands were clean and wet with water from the sink, but his face was decorated in thin lines of red that radiated out from the corners of his lips. He grabbed the local paper and the USA Today and tossed them on the counter. I must have stared too long. He dabbed his cheek delicately and inspected the red spot on his finger. "I suffer from gum disease, Jimmy." Hadn't he seen the blood around his lips? The fluorescent light in the bathroom is bright, almost overbearing, and there's two mirrors. One above the sink and a full-length mirror next to the little machine that sells cologne and condoms. He paid, then went outside. He placed the newspapers on the roof of his T-Bird, then stood to peer into the night, as if contemplating something. I watched him stand there for at least 5 minutes, watching the sky and occasionally sneering with his blood-smeared mouth. Then his body snapped into action, turning to rush back into the building. The automatic doors opened. I saw his face, but his animalistic smile was missing. He bared his teeth. I saw a large canine set in his mouth like tiny white daggers. Before he could step inside, an SUV sped into the parking lot. The man in black retreated to his T-Bird, started the car, and drove into the night. I was never so glad to see a group of drunk club hoppers in my entire life. There was only one bar in the county that stays open until 4 a.m. There had been an ordinance proposed to restrict last call to midnight throughout the county. It was voted down. If it hadn't, I wonder if I would be alive to tell this story. There was a slightly obnoxious group. I think one of the guys stole a candy bar. The women stared into the screens of their iPhones while I rung up their transactions. I wished them good night. They walked out not saying a word. They were my best customers of the night. In the parking lot were the bloody man's newspapers. All summer and into the fall, I wondered if he was reading up on the people who went missing that summer. There were at least two in my part of Illinois, but people go missing all the time in America. All over the world, really, most of them disappear for good. I kept an eye out for the man in the black Thunderbird, but I haven't seen him again. However, something last night got my attention. I was reading Dante's Inferno, scary stuff. Steve had been by to get 10 bucks in gas before his shift. I was looking forward to breakfast and sleep. I saw something move in the alley across the street. It was a long black car with its lights off, the kind they don't make anymore. It could have been a Mercury Cougar or Lincoln Continental, maybe even a Thunderbird. I would have quit this job long ago, but where would I have gone? I've got to pay the rent. Que sera, sera. I should be cleaning the bathroom right now or doing inventory, but I bought Bram Stoker's Dracula today. Think I'll read a few chapters first. No hurry, really. The place is really dead tonight. Pretend you don't see her. Growing up in Arizona, you experience a rich mix of cultures. People come here from the Midwest. Some people brave the desert and come from the South. And some people have been here since before this place was a state. Some say this is because Arizona has no real culture of our own that we borrow from everywhere else. The state is rich in the paranormal. Many Native American tales tell of demons, skinwalkers, vampires, tribes of little people who take children in the night, wendigos up north, or the always popular Thunderbird. This isn't a story about all that. This is the retelling of my experience with a lady in black. Growing up, I would hear stories from my friends who are of Mexican background of La Llorona, the lady in black. The story is meant to keep children inside after dark and to keep them from sneaking out at night. These legends of the lady came north with the people. It seems, though, that she came along too. The story goes something like this. There was a beautiful lady in Old Mexico. She was not from a rich family. Nevertheless, she caught the attention of the son of a Mexican nobleman. They fell in love. In secret, they got married. Not long after that, she became pregnant with twins. Like all ghost stories, this one ends tragically. The nobleman's son was found out. The father was so enraged that his bloodline was tainted with the blood of a commoner that he tried to force the local bishop to grant a divorce to dissolve the marriage. Mexico was very Catholic in those days. The bishop refused. The father eventually seemed to cave in, and he allowed her to move into the house. She eventually gave birth to the twins, one boy, one girl. A year later, the son of the nobleman was called off to war. He didn't return. The father became reclusive, hardly talking or eating. He grew to hate the children that would now inherit everything. The commoners marrying into his family, waiting for him to die to take everything. He ordered his men to take the children to the nearest river and drown them and let their bodies be taken by the current at night, so there would be no proof. The children were taken in the middle of the night without a sound. The mother was kicked out of the house the next day and later accused of killing her children. The townsfolk eventually drowned the heartbroken woman. She didn't put up a fight. She had already died inside. Days later, the nobleman and his men were found dead in his house. Sightings started happening of a beautiful woman dressed in black roaming the streets at night, crying, looking for her children. If you saw her and you were a child, she would stop crying, grab you, and take you to the river where you would be drowned. I told you that the story to tell you this one. I was out running about a month ago, as I often do. I run late at night, around 10 or so. I run near the canals that are all over Phoenix. I take my American bulldog with me so that no one messes around with me. The path I take when I go running is very well lit and is right next to canals and houses, and it's always felt safe until the night I saw her. I was running with my dog as usual. I was listening to my iPod and tracking my mileage. I started to see something in the distance about a quarter of a mile away. It looked like a person under one of the street lamps that light the path at night. I thought nothing of it at first because I often see people when I run. As I got closer, I began to notice that this person wasn't moving, just a silhouette under the light. The closer I got, the more the silhouette started to take shape. When I was about 50 feet away from it, I stopped. My first thought was that it was a homeless person, or this was some sort of prank. My dog started to whimper, then growl, then whimper, then growl again. I had never seen him do that before. I looked at her. I could tell it was a woman. Something about her deeply unsettled me. Then I got the feeling in my stomach that something wasn't quite right and that I needed to get out of there. I couldn't see her face. Her hair was long and black. It was covering it. She looked like she was wearing a short black dress, which was odd, because it was about 60 degrees that night. She was tall, taller than I had first estimated. She was thin, and her arms and legs seemed to be a tad too long for her body. She was just standing under the streetlight. I took my headphones out, because I was going to ask if she was all right. Before I could ask, my ears were filled with a very fast Spanish being, spoken in a whisper. It was raspy. The voice filled my head. She raised one long arm at me and extended her index finger. It looked more like a long tree root than a finger. I had had enough. My dog sensed my fear. I took a step back. She took a step forward. I paused for what seemed like a solid minute, but it was probably a few seconds. That's when I started to hear the crying. It started off as a wail, then grew into a full scream. I turned tail and ran as fast as I could to a main road. When I looked back, she was gone. I ran back to my neighborhood along the main road. The entire time, I was trying to make sense of what had just happened and whether or not somebody was trying to play a prank on me. The entire run home, I could feel eyes on me. I entered my neighborhood. The feeling was still there. I was dreading running back to my house because there are areas that aren't well lit. I decided to sprint the last half mile. As I was doing this, I happened to look down a cul-de-sac that had one light at the end. Yes, she was there. Her silhouette as clear as day. She had not only followed me and kept pace with me, but she had also beaten me to my neighborhood. My dog pulled. We made it to my front door. I opened it, ran in, and slammed it. I took a shower and tried to forget about everything. I locked every door in the house and the door to my bedroom. My dog slept at the foot of my bed that night, and I left the TV on. I drifted to sleep around 3 a.m. The next morning, I woke up and discovered that somehow I had acquired a large scratch that ran down the whole of my bicep. It would eventually scar. A few days after that, I was talking with my neighbor, as I often do. I told him about what had happened. He said this: "I know what that was. The best advice I can give you is to leave her alone. She marked you and will leave you alone. She marks the ones she doesn't like and takes the ones she does." He told me something similar had happened to the person who lived down the street from us and ended up driving him crazy. He said it had all started with a picture his niece drew him. He wouldn't say any more than that. He kept telling me to leave it be. I called my friend Justin after that. I couldn't let this go. How could I? I had been followed by something and was marked. This kind of thing doesn't just happen to people. My buddy's Justin's family is Mexican. He also loves this sort of thing. I described what happened and asked if it was La Llorona, the lady from the story. He told me that it was possible, as there were many vengeful spirits like this. He told me the same story I wrote about above, except with a few key distinctions. The lady was never pregnant, but she was beautiful. She fell in love with a nobleman's son, who played with her heart, promising to marry her, but instead married another woman. The woman, heartbroken, became depressed. She began to see her beauty as a curse. She took a knife and disfigured her face. He told me that no one who saw her face from then on, because she would cover it with her long black hair. When he told me this, I thought back to my encounter and my blood turned to ice. The legend finishes that she longed for someone to love for her heart and not her beauty. This didn't happen and she eventually drowned herself. She was cursed though and now wanders looking for someone who will love her. She will never be satisfied. Her hatred has twisted her. Some people she appears to as a monster. Some she appears to as a beautiful woman. Those she appears to as a beautiful woman will be driven mad with affection for her. Those are the ones she's chosen to love her. Those are the ones who can see her for her and don't see her as a monster. I got off lucky, I guess. This should have been the end of it. This should be where the story ends. It doesn't. I became so curious I went to my neighbors who lived down the street. I had to know what became of the other man who saw her. When I knocked, an old woman answered. I told her that this would sound weird, but that I needed her help. I asked her about the man who used to live here. Turns out it was her ex-husband. I cautiously asked her if she knew anything about a woman in black. She looked at me in a funny way and asked me if I had seen her. I told her I had. She gave me the same advice my neighbor had given me, to leave this alone. I told her that was no longer an option. She sighed and told me to come with her. We went into her attic, and she gave me two large boxes. She said that everything I wanted to know was in there. This was apparently all that her ex-husband had left in his apartment when he disappeared. She told me to read everything, and that if I still wanted to look for her after that, I was a fool. I took the boxes home and spent a weekend going through everything. There were journals, home movies, drawings, and other things that I'm still not sure about. The thing that unnerved me the most was a drawing that looked like it could have been done by a child. It was all black, of a tall, thin figure with long hair, long arms, and fingers that looked like roots. My stomach turned uneasily. I matched the drawing to one of the first journal entries. September 17, 2004. I can't shake the feeling that I am being followed. I went on a walk again last night to see if I could find her. It seems she has found me. Macy, who I found out was his niece, drew me a picture today. She has been staying with us while my brother and his wife are in Denver. She handed me the picture and told me that the lady who lives under the stairs told her to draw it and to tell me she wasn't coming back. I have to see her again. This crazy guy seemed to be in love with this woman. He was obsessed with her. I will include a few more entries. Most of the journals are bogus. He kept them, it seems, to document this to show that he wasn't going crazy. Most of it seems to be babbling on about trying to find her. October 5th, 2004. I am no longer in love with my wife. Lorena, as I've come to call her, has my heart. I saw her face. She showed me her face. She's beautiful. I have to be with her. I understand her. She's not a monster. She's a beautiful woman. October 7th, 2004. She visited me in my dreams last night. I never wanted to wake up. She spoke to me in a voice sweeter than honeysuckle. I have decided to leave my wife. He did. December 13th, 2004. The new apartment isn't grand or glorious, but it's ours. She comes to me at night, telling me that we will soon be together. I'm going to start recording our encounters to show everyone I am not crazy. This is love. This is pure. I am happy, and she loves me. This is where things get really weird. He started taping himself with a video camera. I watched most of it. He kept the lights mostly off. He said that she liked the darkness better. He only had on one or two lights at a time. From the looks of his new home, he was living in a cheap apartment. One video in particular was set up in a bathroom. He had grown a beard by this point. In this video, he took out a razor, and instead of shaving with it, he removed the blade and started cutting his face with it. He took blood from his face and drew a heart in the mirror. He looked over his shoulder into the darkness and said, "I love you too."
Then the whispering started. The camera cut off. The last tape was the weirdest by far. It starts off with him sitting down at his dining table, which was a fold-down card table. He had a large smile on his face. That's all the tape showed for 3 minutes, is him sitting and smiling in the dark. His eyes seemed to follow something around the room. He nodded occasionally. The light above the table eventually went out, at which point the camera turned to night vision. He was still smiling. Then a shadow appeared behind him. Long root-like fingers found their way down his chest until her palm found its place on his shoulder. He closed his eyes and his smiles widened. The last part of this video made my head hurt and my stomach lurch. Mi amor, I heard the voice say on the video before the camera shut off. They never found his body. That night, I packed his stuff up the next morning. I returned his things to his ex-wife. I have stopped looking for her. I wonder if she ever thinks about me. The Snowy Owl. Some legends are true. This statement may seem contradictory considering those narratives we label as myths and legends are widely supposed to be fictitious, having little to no basis in reality. When you've seen what I've seen, however, you find yourself believing that not all those whispered stories between schoolmates or those tales told around the campfire are untruths. Go ahead and scoff at this notion. Many of you will. But one day you too might observe something that challenges your very notion of reality. It all started with a former boss named Gabe. We worked at a law firm together. He was a hotshot lawyer and I was one of the lowly paralegals. Despite the fact that Gabe was higher up the corporate ladder, I worked directly with him on a number of occasions, so I got to know him pretty well. Gabe was a workaholic, and at times he could be a hard ass. He certainly wasn't one for gossip or bullshit, being just about as straight-laced and uptight as they come. Our firm was located in the northeastern United States, nestled in a community that was steeped in traditions and lore left over from the Native American inhabitants of centuries past. Many of the local children grew up on stories of thunderbirds or skinwalkers, and while the community as a whole wasn't overly superstitious, there was a certain amount of respect and reverence paid to these legends. It happened one day that a few co-workers and I were shooting the breeze around the water cooler. To try and creep each other out, we took turns recounting local urban legends we had heard. It was my co-worker Dave who brought up the Snowy Owl. Being a native of the area, I was vaguely familiar with the story, but as Dave recounted this tale, I made note of a few details of the legend that I had been previously lacking. Per Dave, the legend is as follows. A long time ago, three brothers were out hunting in the woods. It was the middle of winter, and the trio had been camped in the forest for several days. Food was scarce, and the brothers were desperate to bring a meal back to their family. On the fourth day, it was decided that the three would split up in order to increase their chances of finding a deer, rabbit, or some other source of meat. They agreed to meet back up at their campsite at dusk, and each of the three headed off in a different direction. At dusk, the three men met back up and shared their findings. The two eldest brothers had managed to catch a couple of squirrels, but the youngest brother had come up empty-handed. When questioned about his lack of success, the brother replied, rather defensively, that he had spotted a snowy owl resting in a tree and that he had managed to wound the bird. Unfortunately, before he could let fly another arrow, the owl flew off. The next day, the youngest brother was determined to make up for his failure the previous day and so set out with a renewed determination. The brother's plan was the same as the day before, with the three splitting up and then reconvening at dusk. In late afternoon, a scream rent the relative silence of the forest, startling both the eldest and second eldest brothers. The men, who were each in a separate area of the woods, ran in the direction of the scream's source, bursting into a small clearing at roughly the same time. Upon reaching the open space, they saw, to their horror, the crumpled body of their little brother. The youngest brother's neck was splayed at an unnatural angle, while blood pooled behind his head. The large branch, half splayed on top of his leg, seemed to indicate that the young man had fallen from the tree, which stood just to the right of him. Approaching the body, the men noticed a single white speckled feather, slightly bloodied, just beside their brother's head. Sadness and despair quickly turned into anger, as the brothers realized that in pursuing the damn bird from the day before, their brother had met with his untimely demise. Thirsty for revenge on the white demon which had led, if indirectly, to their brother's death, The two men decided they would finish the quest their brother had set out on. The next day was spent tracking the owl. It took till late afternoon to find the bird's nest, a slight indentation in the ground littered with white feathers and speckled with blood. There they waited, patiently brooding, seething, and eager to fulfill their bloodlust. Dusk came and went, but still they waited, crouched in the dark, the only source of light coming from the waning gibbous moon. Finally, a slight whooshing could be heard, stirring up the silent darkness. The snow-white form of the owl materialized and alit on the ground. One brother struck, swinging a large branch at the bird. The limb hit the creature with a resounding thwack, sending it sprawling a few feet away. Dazed, the owl tried to get its bearing, tried to take flight and flee, but it moved too slowly, for the second brother fell upon it with his hunting knife. In one slashing arc of the blade, the owl's neck was cut and its life extinguished. The victory was short-lived, for the brothers realized that while they would be bringing back some source of nourishment for their family, they would be leaving their little brother behind. As soon as the sun rose, the men began to make their way out of the thick woods. The journey became more arduous as the thick snow started to fall. Soon the two men were trapped within a world of white, unable to see more than a few feet in front of them. Deciding it was best to make camp for the evening, the two huddled together under a blanket of thick skins. The snow had waned to just a few flurries by the time the last few rays of light disappeared over the horizon. A fire provided a little comfort for the travel-wearied men, and soon the two were lulled into a light doze. What seemed like only moments later, a loud rustling of tree branches jerked them from their slumber. The air was deathly still, almost as if the forest were afraid to breathe. But then the woods began to fill with a cacophony of sounds. The groaning of branches, the crunching of leaves, and a whishing sound grew increasingly louder, increasingly closer. The brothers, now fully awake, clutched at each other, their terror growing with every beat of their heart. The sounds coalesced into one loud racket, a mighty roar, which had the men scrambling to cover their ears. Then, all at once, the noises stopped. Just as fast as the climax of sound had come, so its denouement came. The only sound that filled the clearing then was the harsh breaths of the brothers, marked by little puffs of steam in the cold night's air. Gathering what little courage he had left, the eldest brother yanked a burning branch from the fire and brandished it as if it could ward off the evils of the world. Turning slowly in a circle, the brothers sought to pierce the darkness with what little light he had, trying to peer into every shadow to give the source of their disturbance a face. Holding his breath, the brother strained to see something, anything. Then he noticed it. The complete lack of sound. No night creatures, no rustling leaves, no creaking branches, but mostly shockingly, no harsh breathing. Whipping around to where he left his brother, the man was nearly brought to his knees by the sight that met him. His brother, who just moments before had been clinging to him, lay slumped over on his side. His eyes, wide and unblinking, reflected the firelight, but no warmth remained in them, nor, as it happened, in the rest of his body. Dead. His brother was dead, and upon the brother's unmoving, upturned palm lay a single white, speckled, bloodied feather. Terror the likes he had never known overcame the last surviving member of the trio, and so he ran and ran and ran. According to the local lore, the brother finally made it home the second morning after he had fled the forest. His feet were rubbed raw from the non-stop return journey, and the man could do little more than mumble incoherently. Eventually, his family was able to extract the story from him, and it soon spread to the rest of the village, for it began to be told and retold by locals. Not 2 months later, the eldest brother succumbed to some unknown ailment. His death, too, was said to be tied to some unnatural force, for it is said he claimed to have spotted the snowy owl once again the day before his passing. Henceforth, the snowy owl became known as an omen of death. Those that do not seek it, but rather encounter it unexpectedly, are doomed to die within 24 hours. By the time Dave finished his recounting of the legend, I had chills up and down my arm. Gabe, on the other hand, wasn't impressed. Having eavesdropped on the conversation, he had no qualms adding his 2 cents. If you think that that fluffy white bird from Harry Potter is the harbinger of death, you have a screw loose, he scoffed. Effectively succeeding in ruining the revelry with his condescending attitude, Gabe strode off, and the group of co-workers disbanded, more than a few of us mumbling some not-so-kind words in the lawyer's direction. I went about work the rest of the day, giving no thought to the snowy owl legend. However, the next day it was made clear that the story had stuck more soundly with Gabe. That morning I entered the break room to find a pale Gabe sitting at a table, nursing a cup of coffee. There were bags under his eyes, and he had a distant look in his eyes. Being the decent human being that I am, I inquired to see if anything was the matter. "It was that damn bird. It kept me up all night," was his answer. Curious, I asked what he was talking about. He described his night, saying, "I was woken up last night around 3 a.m. to a light tapping on my window. I thought it was a branch blowing in the wind at first, but the damn noise didn't stop. It was just a constant tap, tap, tap. I looked out the window, and there was an owl, of all things, pecking at the glass. The stupid bird probably confused its reflection for another bird. And then, if that wasn't bad, some idiot driver nearly ran me over as I was crossing the street near my house. I had to dive out of the way to avoid being squished." I grimaced in empathy and then thought of something that might make him chuckle. "Maybe that owl was the omen of your impending demise, just like that legend says," I joked. He didn't laugh, just gave me a scowl. Gabe's day didn't get any better, as each time I saw him he looked more and more haggard. The last time I spoke with him was just after lunch, when I went to drop off some paperwork in his office. As soon as I entered, Gabe grabbed my arm and dragged me into the room, closing his office door. "I think someone is trying to kill me," he all but yelled in my face. His eyes were large and bloodshot, his hair disheveled from countless mussing, his whole countenance read paranoid. "What are you talking about?" I inquired. He recounted his day after our talk that morning. Apparently, in addition to that near hit and run, he had had several other near-death experiences. That day he had tripped over a nail that was sticking up and had fallen down the stairs, nearly breaking his neck in the process. He had also gotten off the elevator just before it malfunctioned and fell 20 stories, and had discovered a small gas leak just before lighting the cigarette he was sneaking in his office. "I think you were right. That owl was an omen," he said, looking genuinely terrified. Now, Gabe wasn't the nicest guy in the world. He worked his interns to the bone, and rarely had anything nice to say about anyone. But I really was starting to feel bad for the guy. Clearly, he had been putting in too much time at work, and had finally reached a breaking point. That, or he was having some sort of midlife crisis. "Gabe," I said calmly, "I'm sure those things were all just coincidences. You're just having a bad day. Maybe you should take the rest of the day off?" He didn't look all that convinced in the face of my reassurances, but he eventually nodded in agreement. "Maybe you're right," he said. "I think I'll head out just as soon as I finish this last letter from my client." Thinking that was the end of things, I made an excuse and left, closing the door to his office behind me. About an hour later, I was startled from my work by a distant crash, followed shortly by a collective of screams. Rushing with a few co-workers to the source of the commotion, we reached the end of the hallway to see that someone had opened Gabe's office door. His window, which looked out over the busy streets 22 stories below, was smashed. The glass debris littering the small stone ledge just outside the window seemed to indicate that it had been smashed from the inside. A few of my co-workers were positioned at the window and were staring in disbelief at the street below. As I made my way over to the window, I had a sinking feeling I knew what sight would greet me. All those stories below, on the now red concrete of the sidewalk, lay a sprawled and lifeless Gabe. The newspapers over the next few days would rule Gabe's death as a suicide, but all remarked how odd one piece of evidence from the scene was, a soft, downy white feather clutched in Gabe's right hand. For some reason, I was put in charge of cleaning out Gabe's office. As I was packing away the personal items from his desk, I came across a well-used notepad. Upon seeing the writing on the pad, my heart leapt into my throat. Over and over were hastily written these words: "The only real myth we tell is when we tell ourselves that we are safe. I'm afraid that the snowy owl legend is true. I'm afraid to look out my window."